Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's the great Charles Mingus. Goodbye, pork pie hat. Charles Mingus was born on this day in 1922. And you listen to the Mark Steiner Show right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We begin our second hour here on the Mark Steiner Show in a conversation with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, who is University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University, author of many, many books, currently at work in a book on Obama and race, and wrote this piece called Ghosts, the Ghost of Cornel West, which appeared the other day and has caused a huge controversy. People reading and writing about it ever since it came out. And he has joined us here on the air. He and I have been exchanging emails, and he's with us now. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir. Great to be here.
As always, you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can log on to our Facebook pages. But either call us, 410-319-8888, if you can, or send us an email, talk@steinershow.org. We've got a number of emails and pieces that we'll read during the course of this hour that have already come in anticipation of this conversation. So, Michael, I guess the first question is, what pushed you to write this lengthy essay on Cornel West at this moment? Michael, we're kind of losing. I'm sorry, Michael. Let me just stop for one moment because we're losing the connection somehow. It must be on a cell phone. I think you're losing this connection. Let's try that one more time. I'm sorry. So what? I think we're kind of losing. You're going in and out. You're breaking up. So we're going to try to call Michael Eric Dyson back. We will try to get this working right here. Sometimes cell phones are not the best when we're on air. But folks, call in 410-319-8888. We've received a ton of emails here from people. I'm going to read a bunch during the course of this conversation and have Michael Eric Dyson respond to some of these issues come up. David Zirin wrote a piece. We've heard nothing yet from Cornel West. Though we have asked him to join us on the air as well, not for this conversation, but for his own conversation, as we prepare to talk to Dr. Michael Eric Dyson about his work. So we'll try again with a cell phone and see if we can get that working and have him join us here. So, ready? Michael?
Sir, sorry about that. I was on a landline, but it seems my cell is working better.
That's really So the question was, why this long piece on Cornel West now, and why now?
Yeah, well, you know, for a while I've been enduring the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune from Professor West, and not just me, but many others, President Obama, Reverend Sharpton, Reverend Jackson, Melissa Harris Perry, and the like. And so we've tried to endure them in a spirit of comedy, and comedy and comedy, perhaps. But the reality is that enough is enough, that after a while, the vicious, vituperative assaults have to be addressed. We have to call him to account for the reckless manner in which he's engaged in an honorable tradition of social criticism and sullied it with his own personal animus. And the reason it's coming out now is because I finished it now. It takes a long time to write. there was no master plan. Let me time this for April the 21st. No, it's when I could get enough time to sit down and do it right. So I've been mulling this for about a year. I've been writing on it for nearly that long. And I've been trying to get it right because I knew that it would have a public impact, obviously, because of the subject that I'm addressing and because of my own particular stake in the matter. So I wanted to get it right, and I wanted to be tough and aggressive but fair. And so this is the time and the moment. And let me address a question you didn't ask me. A lot of people said, well, why not in a black space? Why are you doing this for white people, for their titillation?
That was one of the questions I was going to ask because it came up in some of the emails, right?
Yeah, well, I wanted to write for that well-known black monthly publication of politics named yeah, I guess there isn't one. So that would be kind of tough. The New Republic has had a checkered past when it comes to race.
Yes.
It has to own up to it. It has been called to account by your friend and mine, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and others who have acknowledged that the New Republic has been less than charitable and even more so quite harmful to the presentation of Black identity, and Black intellectual tradition. What better forum then to come into to reorient that magazine, help reorient that magazine under the editorialship of Gabriel Snyder, who I think has done a remarkable job of putting it on a far better standing, a better track, and to move it in a direction where it takes into account the broad swath of American society, ideologically and politically, and African-American and other minority and diverse interests. So I wanted to be part of that tradition of remaking that venerable magazine and giving it a new direction, and thus joining forces with Snyder and others, Jamil Smith, the editor there, Theodore Roth, and others who are doing a great work.
So let me begin with some of the things that you wrote and just talk a bit about them. I mean, one of the quotes we have in here from Cornel West is a quote he had in The Guardian, and the quote is, "I would rather have a white president fundamentally dedicated to eradicating poverty and enhancing the plight of working people than a black president tied to Wall Street and drones." So
sure.
Politically, why does that comment bother you?
I didn't say no. I didn't point it out as one that did bother me. I talked about, I think the sentence that preceded that was that he turned an ideological dispute into a litmus test of racial betrayal. And so I have no problem at all with him making that comment. In fact, I would join him in that comment.
Uh-huh.
That we want principle over pigment. We want character over color, as Dr. King would say. So I'm down with that. But what I'm not down with are the venomous assaults in the name of a doctrinaire leftist belief that undermines the humanity of the people with whom you disagree. Martin Luther King Jr. went up against Bull Connor. I never heard him call Bull Connor horrible, racist, vicious epithets. I never heard him tag him, and he could have been righteous in doing so, but never did so. If Martin Luther King Jr. didn't call Bull Connor names, I don't think that West has to call Obama or Dyson or Sharpton or Harris Perry names. Now, you can be aggressive in your criticism. You can hold us to account. You can point out the contradictions. But when you deny me access to my own humanity as your opponent, there's something more at stake than the change of language. And it takes more than a change of language. Okay, I'll say the same thing. I just want to talk about your mama. Well, when you predispose yourself to be righteous in the conversation and you rig the conversation to favor your particular stance or ethical or moral orientation, then you're not engaging in an open-ended debate and dialogue that characterizes democracy at its best and Professor West's path at its best.
So in one of the pieces, you spent a lot of time in this essay, and it's an intense essay that I reread again last night, and then I was reading many other things that people had written, Dave Zirin's piece. Have you read Dave Zirin's piece that he wrote in The Nation?
I'll respond to that when you get a chance.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment, too, because he's mm-hmm. he's a friend of both of ours, as we are friends. And
I love him.
And yeah, I do, yeah. too, and Cornell's been on the show a number of times. So this is it was hard for me to read because I was really trying to figure out how to put my hands around some of the stuff you were saying.
I've done your show with Cornell and Tavis.
You have.
Doing the past the mic.
That's yeah. right. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. But when you wrote about his book, Prophetic Thought in the Postmodern Times and Prophetic Reflections, and when you quote him saying, "I'm a prophetic Christian freedom fighter," and as he added in his memoir, "I see my role as," and then someone who feels both a Socratic and prophetic calling. I mean, do you think that Cornell was actually calling himself a prophet, or that he sees himself following the prophetic tradition, which might be very different? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, he said, I, you know, feel myself following this prophetic tradition. I mean, that would be splitting hairs there to say that, if you know, that he doesn't see himself as a prophet. Yes, he sees himself as a prophet. I mean, if you read the New York Magazine profile of him, a self-proclaimed prophet. So he's widely acknowledged as a person who has anointed himself both a prophet and a follower of that prophetic tradition. And I make the distinction in the piece. I said nothing wrong with being inspired by a prophetic tradition, but calling yourself a prophet and anointing yourself a prophet is another thing. And then being able to expel and embrace prophets as if you're able to anoint them is a bit more of hubris that needs to at least be called out or identified as a problematic construction. So, yeah, he sees himself as a Socratic and prophetic figure, and he sees himself as a person who inherits those vocabularies and the vision and vocation. And I took pains in the piece to point out that as inspiring as he has been, he's been throwing dirt and mud on other people who are legitimate prophets like Sharpton and Jackson, and whether you agree with them or not. whether you have legitimate criticisms, including Professor West, that are persuasive morally, to engage in throwing mud at them because they're not real prophets, they're fake, or they're sullying the tradition, when you haven't even stood for the discipline of becoming a prophet, of dealing with the religious authority that mandates, and being willing to stand up within your religious tradition and speak truth to power by submitting yourself to an authority that you are willing then to offend. In that sense, that may be a bit inside baseball for some people, but given the kind of claims he was making, I felt it was necessary to go that route.
There was one piece, there was a dialogue that was created with about 20-some people that I've been taking part in ever since last night and reading, and that people like James Early and others are part of, Barbara Ehrenreich and many other people are in this conversation, Ethelbert Miller. And one of the comments here was, they were going back and forth about the efficacy of what you wrote. And what one comment was, but what I get from Dyson is a warning about the unseemly vanity that can consume "quote unquote" leaders. And I was thinking about that in terms of this conversation we're having today. Because I mean, I read people saying, accusing you of the same thing, having the same kind of unseemly vanity and who you hang out with, and blah blah blah. But Tavis, they could yell that at anybody who has a personality. So what about that? I mean, it seems, how much of that is what's fueling some of this?
It's true. I mean, that's true for all of us. True for me, true for Wes, true for anybody who's in those circles. That's, you know, nobody hates criticism like a critic, huh?
That's right.
So of course that's true. And it is unseemly vanity that can seduce one, that can traduce one in a Shakespearean sense, into, a rather unseemly habit of celebrating one's own connection to the rich and famous. And West does that plenty enough in his own memoir. And here's the problem with that. You know, all of us got egos, and we love to hang out and talk about who we're hanging out with. But if you're beating up on other people for doing that, dude, you're living in a glass house. Stop it. You can't say those kind of things. See, that's the problem with West. Not only does he have the vanity, he has the vicious disregard of self-inventory, the pitiless self-examination that should be one of the major characteristics of any prophetic Christian. And so he beats up on other people. Oh, they just want to have access now. They just want access to the White House. They just want Obama to love them, and so on. Let me read your memoir. Oh, yeah, there you are, bragging about hanging out with Clinton. Where's your memoir? There you are, bragging about knowing Snoop. There you are, bragging about hanging out with Jay-Z. There you are, bragging about hanging out with P. Diddy. And it goes on and on and on and on. So the thing is, don't throw any stones if you're living in the glass house, but all of us should be reprimanded and find reproach in that example. So, yeah, for people who would say, hey, Dyson, you might be subject to the same thing. Amen. Hit me on it. You know, I have had access and enjoy that access, but also have tried to remain fairly self-critical and critical even of the positions and authorities with which I hobnob and enjoy access. But all of us should be held to account, and none of us are exempt.
Let me go to the phones here. People are calling in. I have some of the emails we want to read. We're here with Michael Eric Dyson talking about his piece that he just wrote in the New Republic about Cornel West, the ghost of Cornel West, a very long and powerful piece, and we're going to get our thoughts and the complications of those thoughts. 410-319-8888. Tweet us here at Mark Stein. A lot of people are listening. They've been tweeting about this conversation. If you have thoughts, you can put them on Twitter as well. 410-319-8888. And Jeff in Baltimore, you're on the air.
This is really exciting. Thank you, guys. I really miss Dr. Dyson being on the air on WEAA. That's number one, and I wish he could be brought back to WEAA. Thank you so much, Mark, for having him on the air this morning. Also, I miss Tavis and Cornel West being on. I think they were actually on WYPR.
Well, they were on this station as well, right?
Yeah, right. And on Sunday evenings, I think they were on both stations at one point. And so that's striking. And then Michelle Martin, I can't believe that there wasn't. Oh, I don't want to forget Doug Hughes. I got so many things on my mind, but the most Martin Luther King-like protest that has been really effective recently, and I haven't heard Mikulski or anybody else come out and talk about how we might really be able to recover our country if someone would listen up to that guy who flew into and landed on the and.
Right. But what can you focus your kind of comment on our conversation here?
Oh, geez. Well, concerning really, those are my comments.
Okay.
As much as anything, I just miss black voices, Cornel West and Tavis, and Dr. Dyson being on WEAA more often, and on YPR and
okay.
other outlets.
Jeff, thank you so much. And I let me just say that I think that there's a. We've spent other hours talking about National Public Radio and their problems with race, and they are legion.
yeah, no question. I mean,
when you can't find money for Dyson, when Michelle Martin can't find have a program taken off, those are totally different issues. But I think that we've had those conversations. They deserve a conversation. I'm sorry, Michael. What were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I think so. That Jeff sounded so much like Jeff Stout, my dear professor and mentor at Princeton University. I don't think that was him, but it reminded me of his genius and his gift and his gravitas. But the point about us being on the air, I think, is incredibly important. NPR has to take account in stock of its own lily white tradition and its even outreach to minority communities, even as it has also afforded many of us an opportunity to express our views and engage in serious conversation. So, as usual, it's never a perfect space, but it's one that is constantly being reconstituted in order to more closely adhere to the traditions of open dialogue that public radio celebrates at its best. And I'm glad to be on the air with you this morning.
I'm glad you're here, too. And let me come back to some of what we were talking about here before we go back to the phones. Katrina, you are the next caller up at 410-319-8888. John has had an email here and is saying that it would be interesting to know why Dr. Dyson thinks that all of this means to, quote unquote, everyone else. I mean, how does the general public benefit from this in the wake of the oppressive economic conditions and the growing awareness of police brutality?
Well, because, you know, we can chew gum and walk at the same time. The same, you know, society, I'm concerned about Rekia Boyd, I'm concerned about Renisha McBride, I'm concerned about Freddie Gray, I'm concerned about Michael Brown, I'm concerned about Luther Vandross's birthday the other day, one of the great vocalists of all time. I'm concerned about whether or not Kendrick Lamar's album is being read correctly and that the unmitigated blackness, as one scholar has called it, is being celebrated. I'm thinking about Taylor Swift and her love for Kendrick Lamar and her attention to her own existential and domestic dramas. I'm concerned about Empire, how soon it will be back on the air. I'm a human being who's concerned about a lot of things at the same time. And I think that I take what I do with deathly and deadly seriousness, but I don't take myself that seriously at all. So I think that we have to have an understanding that we should all be concerned with and consumed by serious and critical issues, but at the same time, we should also live our humanity and express ourselves by embracing joy and celebration and time off. And I think that what this piece may do is to help us focus on a lot of the stuff that we haven't talked about for obvious reasons. There's a long section in there about writing and scholarship and the difference between talking and writing. That can help a lot of graduate students. There's stuff in there about friendship and love and celebration of one's mentor. That can help a lot of people. There's stuff in there about politics and how you comport yourself well in the midst of a culture where you are already a minority and under assault, and yet at the same time you want to celebrate criticism without being personal. So there's a lot of stuff in there for a lot of people. It's 10,000 words. It has a lot in there for a lot of people, and it's not simply about one thing. That's why I think it can help the larger conversation, spur us on. Maybe if it can correct an elder who has veered off the tracks and say, hey, this is not how we behave ourselves when we're trying to make criticisms, even if we are critical of each other. There's a way to do it, and there's a way not to do it. There's a healthy, helpful, uplifting, edifying way, and there's a way that's destructive. That is a lesson for everybody, not just us.
Some people, like Dave Zirin in the piece that he wrote, kind of look at this as he didn't put it like a pro-Obama piece, but the whole question about Obama and his black president, as the first black president, is a complex piece.
It's very complex. And look, I agree. Look, Dave, I'm not sure, go on.
I was just thinking about this because I was thinking about a big piece of this is about Sharpton, which we'll get to in a little bit. But you know, when I remember when I first saw Barack Obama standing there with Michelle in Denver, I remember the stream of tears coming down my face, just imagining there could be a black family in the White House after having stood in Atlantic City with Fannie Lou Hamer in '64 as a kid, you know, and watching this happening in front of my eyes, and then really being distraught about most of the policies and how he handled many things that he did when he did become president, and the critiques many people gave, and then switching again, watching the racists attack him, so I didn't want to see them throw a black family out of the White House, but still. It's a complex emotional and political question, right?
It really is. And look, nobody knows it better than I do, which is why I've been saying what I've been saying and criticizing. Have you read my op-ed in the Washington Post that the Obama administration was deeply chagrined by? Maybe not. Have
I did.
You heard me? You know, not you. I'm saying, but people in the broader audience. You read everything, bro. You read everything, okay? Because I hear from you. So I'm saying you, the public, right? Have you heard my disagreements and disputes and spats? Probably not, because I don't say them in nasty, vicious way, but I've been on the air prosecuting my differences as well as defending him against the unprincipled assault by racists and right-wingers who have tried to assault his humanity, which is why it is especially important that West not replicate the same modus vivendi, the modus operandi. Don't do the same thing that the people who unavowedly hate Obama do. Preserve his humanity even as you aggressively criticize him. So it is difficult to do that because there's a lot of uncritical black celebration of Obama, and any criticism of Obama is seen as betrayal. So I get that, and which is why I've defended West and Tavis and others in their ability to criticize him. But on the flip side of it, why is it that you're acting as if his humanity is not at stake, and that when West said in one interview he wanted to slap Obama upside his head? Really? You are too sensitive to the black body's use in public domains and the way in which it has been attacked in an unprincipled fashion for you to be talking about slapping somebody upside their head. So it is a complicated thing, and Dave Zirin, my friend, is right to point to that. But let me toss a kind of funny rejoinder to my dear friend Dave Zirin.
Okay,
he makes an analogy there. He says, "Look," he says, "Cornel West is not
Mike Tyson.
He's a Muhammad Ali, but not Muhammad Ali at the height of his power. But Muhammad Ali." And Dave Zirin is too kind of a man. He's exhibiting the very kind of gracious criticism, though aggressive, against me, that I'm urging West to do against Obama and me. So Dave Zirin is too kind to say Dyson is George Foreman, who was helping him. but Dave Zirin is too skilled a writer for me not to draw that conclusion, and I love him for that. He didn't say rope-a-dope because he didn't want me to call a dope in any way, but that is the consequence of it. So I'll extend his criticism on his behalf against me by proxy. So he's saying that basically I rope-a-dope myself because Wes stood there and took all my pummeling. And I want to say to him, Dave Zirin, you got the right story. You just got the wrong guys. Wes, for 5 years, 6 years, has been wailing away, pummeling his opponent. I have remained silent. This is my response. So, dude, you got it wrong. You're right that one of us is George Foreman and the other is Muhammad Ali, but I'll leave it to you to decide. But the reason I wasn't upset is because I love being called George Foreman because I wanted to have that grill that he made and make those millions of dollars. That would be great.
We're going to take a very brief break. We're going to come right back with Michael Tyson. Michael Tyson, listen to me.
Michael Tyson. It's ridiculous. I think it's crazy. It's calling me Mike Tyson.
Michael Eric Dyson. Talking about his piece, The Ghost of Cornel West. Back to join us again right after this break. Jarena, we're going to come to your call as soon as we come back. Read this, how the email has come in, and explore this in greater depth as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. That's the fabulous, incredible, brilliant, crazy, mad Charles Mingus. That's Fables of Faubus. He was born on this day in 1922. We are here with Michael Eric Dyson, University Professor of Sociology at Georgetown University, author of numerous books. One coming out now is Obama and Race, which we're looking forward to, talking about the piece he wrote in The Republic, The Ghost of Cornel West. 410-319-8888. Cornel, I'm going to go right to the phones, if that's cool with you. Let's go to Jarena. You're on the air. Good morning, Jarena.
I just want to tell Mike Dyson that I am just so happy to hear him speak to this. I don't get a chance to listen to your show, Mark, as much as I want to. And I just happened to hear, you know, turn it on and hear about the ghost of Cornel West. And I was just wondering what it was going to be. Because for over a year now, I was so excited when this show first started with Tavis and Cornel West, and soon became so distressed, and I mean depressed. I have all these notes of how, you know, how horrible it was in terms of seeing this deterioration in the way that he was communicating. I just was, and I don't have the skill, obviously, as and talent as Mike Dyson, but for him to come up with this article, I'm so looking forward to reading it, and to speak to this kind of truth, so that we can, you know, have that bigger truth for all of us. Anyway, I just want to say thank you.
Thank you so very kindly for that. And, you know, to speak to her point, look, it took a lot for me to write this piece because I love Cornel West and I admire him. And I put that in the piece deliberately because I wanted people to understand that. But like this caller, I was equally distressed at not the criticism, because I think the criticism is necessary. The impulse to criticize is extremely valuable. But the manner, the method, and ultimately the style and the aesthetic, but also some of the content, because those two bleed together. And in Black traditions, what you say is as important as how you say it, and how you say it is just as important as what you say. Those two bleed together, and they co-author meaning. And I think that West had given himself over to an uncritical hubris when it came to the belief that his critique was the only one, that his was the righteous one, that his voice could be the only one crying in the wilderness. And there was a kind of martyr complex, or at least a prophetic one, that I think he can be relieved of usefully and accept his role as a public intellectual and a gadfly and a paid pest, as I say in the piece. Those are honorable traditions, but they don't imbue one with the co-signature of God. And that makes a big difference. I'm not saying you don't feel led by God to do what you got to do, but God is always, you know, quite cautious to remind us, as God did Elijah. Hey, you know, when Elijah said, I only am left, O Lord, now take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers. What? Slow down. God said, you're tired, you're hungry. Guess what, though? There's 7,000 other people over here who are doing the right thing that you don't even know about. So West could do well to revisit those scriptures that he so brilliantly exegetes on occasion and understand that the prophetic tradition is much larger and deeper than him, that God assigns prophets in ways that he may not agree with, he being West, and that there's a bigger battle to be waged here. And instead of beating up on the people who are ostensibly on your side, disagree with them if they fall out of favor with you, vigorously criticize them, but don't assault their intelligence or their integrity, and don't deprive them of their humanity in public conversation. And I think I'm equally outraged by that dissent, and I was, pushed into writing this article in this way at this time in this manner.
Let me go to the front here again, then I have a couple questions of my own before you have to run. And I think the next caller, 410-319-8888, is actually, I think, your former executive producer, Carla Wills. Carla, welcome to the program. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Doc?
How you doing there, Miss Carla?
I'm good. You know, a lot of people have asked me about this piece because, you know, we've worked together. And there are a couple of things that I knew right off. One, I knew it was a very, very long time coming. We had had Cornel West on the show when we did the Michael Eric Dyson show. And I remember at the time when we had him on, I'm thinking, do you really want him on the show? But I will say that Doc had such respect and love for Dr. West that even when he was, you know, saying a lot of the stuff he was saying, he held his tongue for so long and still wanted him to be a part of the show because of that respect he had. And, you know, and so I knew that this must have been a very difficult thing to write. I knew with the depth of scholarship in this piece that it was a long time coming, so I'm glad to know that it did take you quite some time to write it, because I knew that. But the second thing that I observed is that, in as much as this is part this comes out of this very academic scholarly tradition. This piece, it's also very much out of that hip-hop sensibility that I know is so much a part of you. And when I read it, I said, you know, it's like when Eminem said, "Don't let me go second, because nobody's going to come back from it." This is very much like Nas. You know, I know that's one of your favorite hip-hop artists. The one thing I keep hearing about this is that basically you ethered him, Dr. West, in this piece. And very much, you know, that's kind of what a lot of people are hearing. You know, you read this, and it's like you really can't come back from it because the argument was laid out with such robust, you know, scholarship, and but with, you know, with the love as well for this person who was your mentor. And so, you know, I didn't want to say a whole lot when people have been asking me about it, but I just wanted to say that I appreciated all that went into it just because of our personal working relationship.
Right. Wow, the brilliant and beautiful Carla Wills. Thank you so much for clarifying so much of that. I'm going to let that statement stand, but I want to send love to you and appreciation for perhaps explaining to others the difficulty of this choice, my deep respect for Professor West, and at the same time, my hip-hop sensibilities and my understanding of the currents of pop culture and how this might be read. Thank you so much for that.
Carla, thank you for calling in. I was hoping you would have a perspective on this after we spoke yesterday, so one of my favorite people on the planet. She is. She's.
No, it's mine too. Yeah.
So, but Carla, let me, before we go back to the phones, there's a question I do want to ask about this. And the piece around the critique around Al Sharpton that went back and forth about on the piece that you wrote and the Corbell's attacks on Al Sharpton. And as disclaimer, let me just, you know, just say I have been on MSNBC and this is, I want to be clear about that, and that needs to be out there as well. But you know, the people could criticize. I could see a critique of Reverend Sharpton on lots of ways. I mean, because more than Melissa Harris Perry, whose show I've appeared on numerous times, and more than some of the other critics. I mean, Al Sharpton, I mean, does defend Barack Obama at every level all the time. I've rarely heard a critique of President Obama, and there are critiques that could be had of Sharpton that, you know, that I would love to talk to him about. And as I would Tavis Smiley about when they worked with the banks to convince poor black people to take these loans that they shouldn't have taken, and helped destroy so many hundreds of black lives in America. These are real issues. So, I mean, he can and should be asked these questions, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I don't disagree with you at all. Look, I wrote, if you read my book, April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr.'s Death and How It Changed America, I've got chapters on both Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. And guess what? I'm very critical of them while also appreciating their particular genius.
Right.
That's the nature of life. They've gotten some great stuff and some bad stuff. But the thing about Sharpton, I think that's what's most interesting. Look, Sharpton is in a difficult position as the premier black leader who, at the time of his premier access and ascent, the first black president comes along. Now, imagine the masses of black people who will not tolerate any kind of critique. This is the difficulty that many of us, including West and Tavis and myself, have confronted as we've tried to offer criticism for Obama. And you'll note in my piece, I tried to give West a three-part approach to how strategically you could criticize Obama and get away with it, so to speak, without being seen as a hater. But that's for another occasion. So there's no question that it's extremely difficult. And imagine how difficult it is for Sharpton to be the leader of black America, a preeminent leader of black America, and at the same time be hating on Obama. That ain't going to sell. At the same time, how do you push back? How do you maintain your critical edge? He made a choice that he's talked about of not doing that in public. So the question is, behind the scenes, is Sharpton doing things that we may not be able to tell that might keep Obama from veering into certain directions otherwise? Now, he's subject to criticism. He should be criticized, like we all should be criticized. But I think Al Sharpton gets a bad rap, not on that issue, but on the issue which people say, well, he's illegitimate. Look at his hair. Look at his dress. Look at what he did. Look at Tawana Brawley. Look, this man is an Emersonian self-rebegetting figure. And when I put Al Sharpton's hair next to George Washington's, I don't see much difference. So he went, not only James Brown, he went back to George Washington for his follicular fidelity. So I'm saying Al Sharpton is a much more complicated, much more intelligent, much more engaged leader who, and let me give you an example of how important Al Sharpton is. Back when Al Sharpton was the big Al Sharpton, it's like big Luther and small Luther, right? Luther Vandross.
Right.
It's like the big Al Sharpton with his hair and his, you know, and his running suits, and people were ashamed of him. Oh, my God, this is our black leader. Al Sharpton was obsessed with an issue he is still obsessed with today, and that people thought back then, though, that's only for poor or working-class black people who are not healed. And the politics of respectability kept us from appreciating what Al Sharpton was doing. What was he doing? Putting police brutality front and center in black American life. Al Sharpton was prescient about that. And right now, in your city, with a black mayor, we're dealing with the death of Freddie Gray.
Yes, we are.
Spinal cord severed. So I'm telling you, Al Sharpton put on the agenda of American society the preoccupation with police brutality that is the central issue of black America today. That's how important he is.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Jane, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Thank you. I'm calling because I read the piece, and it's very long, and so and it's very complex. But I wanted to say... I thought it was incredibly timely also, and I have revered West in the past. I think his early writings in particular were absolutely seminal in the way I conceived black and white relationships, and I have been feeling acutely uncomfortable with what has been happening those times I've been hearing him. But more important, perhaps, I felt with this article, because it's so complex, is that it articulated, I'm going to say particularly for whites, but just across the board, the extraordinary contribution of the prophetic tradition, the black prophetic tradition, setting it in a context, showing its values. I just felt that, you know, you can shred a person publicly, and I did feel actually that the article went a little over the top with some of the embarrassing celebrity adoration. I mean, I just felt really embarrassed reading all that. Mm-hmm. But I felt for me the value of it was that it, well, a lot of values. I mean, I just think it touches on so many important things today. And even this last conversation about, you know, the fear of criticizing that you will be seen as, if you're white, racist, or hating. Anyway, many points I thought were absolutely vital, and I'm just really grateful to Professor Dyson that he wrote it.
Thank you,
well,
Jane.
Thank you so kindly. Thank you so kindly for that, and I appreciate that, and I received that criticism as well. I understand the kind of, you know, response of embarrassment, even squeamishness, but I must remark that all of that was drawn from Professor West's own book. It was drawn from his own memoir. And but again, I think that the broader point she's making there about that prophetic tradition, I took pains and care to delineate it, to decipher its importance, and to express that and to translate that for others who only heard of that tradition through West and his very interesting, vigorous, but slanted perspective on that. And I wanted to step back and do a kind of genealogical portrait, if you will, in a Foucaultian tradition, briefly, as it were, of that tradition and figure out where it's come from, who were the major figures, what its moral intensity is about, and therefore to show how West is wanting in regard to that, even though he is often and powerfully appealed to that tradition. And I think it's important to do the work. It is a long piece, but it's a piece that has to be long and complicated and complex because the figure it addresses is, and the issues that it addresses are as well.
I know you have to run here in just a minute. Can we just try to squeeze?
Man, I got as long as you need to stay on, brother. I'm on with you. Yeah, I got time to do it, you know.
We do have another segment we have to go to in a few minutes to close out our usual Wednesday shows. But let me try to get another caller in here at least and see if I can squeeze one in. 410-319-8888. Theodore, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen, how are you?
Good morning.
I'm looking. I was remembering a part of the, I think it's the preamble, and saying we want a more perfect union. So I was thinking, you know, because Mr. Dyson's a Christian, and we all believe, and I was saying a little Mr. Dyson, a little Steiner, a little Sharpton, a little West, a little Obama, a little Michelle, and all those parts make us up as humans, because you could put all those parts together and they wouldn't even come close to the wisdom and the perfection that the good Lord Jesus gave us on this earth. So you got to remember, he got criticized and he never made a mistake. So we got to look at each other in criticism that's not harmful, but that's helpful, because none of us are perfect. I enjoyed Mr. Dyson when he was on TV. I enjoyed Mr. Steiner, although sometimes we disagree. And I ask us all to remember that we all, as good as we may be, as good as God made us, we all going to have to account to him. So there are none of us absolutely perfect. You take all those parts and a lot of the parts I didn't mention in us, and guess what? We would still be a more imperfect union. Right. So just remember that. I enjoy Mr. Dyson. Wish he did have his own program and talk show. And one more question. The New Republic is a magazine I can get on the stand, right?
Correct.
And I can't get out like I used to, but I'd just like to get me a copy to read the article. And say,
it'll be out in at the beginning of May. If you look on the, you know, like May 1st, you should be able to get that on, you know, on the stands.
And I'd like to ask you kind of a trivial question. What do you all think, and he lost a little bit of integrity to me because of this. What do you all think that the professor who does the genealogy, he refused to put on his program when he was asked that Ben Affleck had slave ancestors? What do you think about that?
Well, we can go there for a minute, but we do have to take a break here. But what are your thoughts on that, Mike? We talked about that a little bit in the last hour on reparations. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's complicated. I mean, look, I understand Ben Affleck, God bless his heart, he didn't want that to appear. But that's part of the politically correct. That's part of the poisonous atmosphere that doesn't admit that, look, we can change, we can grow. It would have been better for us to know that, to show what a contrast between your mother who fought for civil rights and your ancestors who didn't. I think that would have been.
I thought the same thing.
I understand Affleck's disinclination to do so because he's been such a champion for so many good causes, and I love Ben Affleck. I love Professor Gates, and I understand how difficult of a choice that was. He ultimately said that they made an editorial decision, but we know other things into that. And it's a complicated role, and I'm going to leave it to you big time, Wig, to work that out.
Michael Eric Dyson, I'm sorry we have to go to this next segment, but we have something booked. We got to get to that, and I do appreciate, our conversations online and that you're willing to come on and have this conversation with us and all the work you do. We're going to link to the article, The Ghost of Cornell West, on our website at steinershow.org, so you can read it before it comes out the newsstand and see what he's been saying. And looking forward to his new book coming out on Obama and race coming out soon. Michael, thanks so much, my brother. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, my brother.
Anytime. Bye-bye. We take a brief break. You're hearing the great Richie Havens under me, who passed away on this day in 2013. We'll be right back. Stay with us as we look at Lexington Market and the City Paper.
Let the sun rain fall and let the dewy clouds enfold.